behavioral study. When these individuals expressed serious concerns about the secret testing of employees, the program was terminated. The State Department was told that the best countermeasure it could take was to turn the 10-story embassy building into a giant Faraday cage. In a declassified memo dated April 3, 1965, a consultant suggested a selection of suitable copper screening and mandatory coverage of all window openings. A vicious debate ensued among defense scientists, with accusations of hysteria and malfeasance being hurled back and forth. One of the Navy's top scientists, Dr. Samuel Koslov, led the charge of those who insisted that the Moscow signal was harmless. The actual physical results were non-existent, but the real psychological trauma, in this case in a group of well-educated and dedicated people, was sad and startling, Koslov later wrote in the Applied Physics Laboratory Alumni Digest. ARPA's Richard Cesaro and others vehemently disagreed. Based on the evidence that the electromagnetic beam could penetrate the human nervous system, Cesaro argued that it was necessary to determine exactly what kind of weapon this was and whether the Soviets have special insight into the effects and use of athermal radiation on man. In 1969, the Defense Department quietly expanded ARPA's Project Pandora to include the human. Highly classified studies, codenamed Big Boy and Project Bazaar, now projected microwave beams at unwitting sailors stationed in the Philadelphia Naval Yard. The experiments would remain secret for 7 years. Throughout the 1960s, as a result of the escalation in the ESP wars, electromagnetic weapons were having lethal, real-world consequences, certainly on U.S. Embassy personnel and Navy sailors. During this same time frame, Soviet efforts in psychokinesis were also gaining momentum and garnering attention within the Defense Department and the CIA. One Russian individual commanded the Pentagon's attention more than anyone else, and that was a pretty 44-year-old woman named Ninel Kulingina, who was purported to be able to move matter with her mind. Born in Leningrad in 1926, Kulingina's parents named her after Vladimir Lenin, the founder of the Russian Communist Party and leader of the Bolshevik Revolution. Ninel, a popular girl's name, is Lenin spelled in reverse. In the West, she was erroneously identified as Nina, and the name stuck. Kulingina, a decorated war hero, had been a frontline soldier for Mother Russia during World War II. At the age of 14, she joined a Red Army tank regiment along with her father, brother, and sister before the Nazis invaded Leningrad the following year. For her service as a tank radio operator, Kulingina was awarded the Military Merit Medal. She left the army in 1946 and married a naval engineer. She'd always had psychokinetic abilities, Kulingina told Science News, which first manifested themselves when she was a child. Sometimes when she got angry, objects around her spontaneously moved. Starting in the mid-1960s, Kulingina's mysterious ability to move matter with her mind became the subject of a state-run TV program called Science Films, produced by Leningrad Studios. Kulingina was filmed using psychokinesis to move objects sealed inside a glass aquarium, including metal salt shakers, matchsticks, and cigar canisters. In the United States, skeptics cried fraud. But the CIA and the Defense Department were not so sure, declassified documents indicate, owing to a film of a classified experiment in a research laboratory at the Ukhtomsky Military Institute in Leningrad on March 10, 1970. In the film, Kulingina was shown to be able to stop a frog's heart with her mind. One explanation, analysts wrote, was that trickery or fraud was at play, and that the film was part of a Soviet disinformation campaign to trick U.S. defense officials into thinking Kulagina could actually accomplish this. An alternative explanation was that she had psychic powers. What is certain is that the film caused uproar within the American defense community. Seated beside Kulagina was Gennady Sergeyev, the Soviet military doctor in charge of the experiment. After roughly 20 minutes of mental preparation, Kulagina indicated she was ready to begin. On the table in front of her, a technician placed a ceramic jar. Inside it was a small lump, the frog's heart still beating. The organ had been surgically removed from the animal's body and set in Ringer's solution, which can keep the heart of a small animal beating for roughly 1 hour. Thin wires and electrodes attached the heart to an electrocardiogram machine, allowing scientists to track the heart's beats per minute. Kulagina's physiology was similarly monitored. Sergeyev instructed her to start. With both hands in front of her on the table, she began concentrating with the purposeful intent of stopping the frog's beating heart. According to the declassified documents, Kulagina's heart rate rose to 240, her blood pressure became elevated, and heightened biological luminescence radiated from her eyes. In the first of the experiments, the electrocardiogram, EKG, indicated heart activity ceased about 7 minutes after Kulagina began concentration on stopping the heart, wrote a Defense Department analyst. After the measurement was recorded, Kulagina then reactivated the heart so it began beating again. A second test followed. In a second experiment, with another heart in a metallic container, heart activity ceased after 22 minutes, wrote the Defense Department analyst. In both experiments, Kulagina was 1.5 meters, 4.9 feet, from the target hearts. A separate experiment followed. Kulagina attempted to increase the heart rate of a skeptical physician who'd been hooked up to a separate EKG machine. Abrupt changes were noted in both people, Kulagina and the skeptical physician, within 1 minute after the experiment began, the analyst wrote. After 5 minutes, Dr. Sergeyev judged the heart activity of the physician had reached dangerous levels and the experiment was terminated. Disbelieving defense analysts argued that this was further proof of a Soviet disinformation campaign, that the ruse of the so-called skeptical physician was gilding the lily, so to speak. Others were not so sure. This is perhaps the most significant PK test done, and its military applications, if true, are extremely important, cautioned an official with the Medical Intelligence Office of the U.S. Army. In response, the Defense Department called for a joint intelligence assessment of the Soviet psychoenergetic threat, a term invented by the Pentagon to include all matters related to Soviet anomalous mental phenomena research and electromagnetic weapons programs. The task fell to the Medical Intelligence Office of the U.S. Army, Office of the Surgeon General. During the Vietnam War, this office had been moved to the newly formed Defense Intelligence Agency, where it assessed everything from a foreign country's medical capabilities to its infectious diseases. In 1970, the office was transferred back to the Surgeon General's office. Because it was the mandate of the Medical Intelligence Office to assess foreign biotechnical developments of military medical importance, assessing the Soviet psychoenergetic threat was its job. The two-year effort resulted in a 174-page classified report called Controlled Offensive Behavior, USSR, published in 1972. This study is a review and evaluation of Soviet research in the field of revolutionary methods of influencing behavior, stated the author, Captain John Lamothe. intended as an aid in the development of countermeasures for the protection of U.S. or Allied personnel. Evidence indicated that the Soviets were rapidly developing methods of controlling or manipulating human behavior through subtle, non-identifiable means, Lamothe found, with influencing techniques including psychopharmacology, i.e. drugs, subliminal messaging, and electromagnetic weapons. With regard to extrasensory perception and psychokinesis research, Lamothe wrote, "Communist state authorities, the military, and the KGB display an unusual, disproportionate interest in parapsychology, and that military involvement in psi, i.e. psychic, research is confirmed." Lamothe broke down the danger into four categories of existential threat. Soviet agents with psychoenergetic abilities hypothetically could, 1. Disable at a distance U.S. military equipment of all types, including spacecraft. 2. Know the contents of top-secret U.S. documents, the movements of our troops and ships, and the location and nature of our military installations. 3. Mold the thoughts of key U.S. military and civilian leaders at a distance. And 4. Cause the instant death of any U.S. official at a distance. In essence, wrote Lamothe, through the use of targeted extrasensory perception and psychokinesis, a Soviet agent could disrupt military technology, access state secrets, influence the action of national leaders, and assassinate U.S. officials. These threats were what U.S. military and intelligence scientists needed to focus on, he wrote. Citing scientists and experts, Lamothe saw an immediate need to create a program to mirror the Soviets' psychic warfare undertakings. "I am really disturbed," Oliver J. Caldwell, a former Office of Strategic Services officer who was known to run operations for the CIA, told Lamothe, "because if the United States does not make a serious effort to move forward on this new frontier, in another 10 years, it may be too late." Sybil Leek, who Lamothe identified as a noted astrologer and author, warned that there is a great danger that within the next 10 years, the Soviets will be able to steal our top secrets by using out-of-the-body spies. Dubbed England's most famous witch, Leek advised the CIA on witchcraft and the supernatural. Lamothe's report raised issues that merited further inquiry, but the alarmist nature of his text limited its distribution. To those in the know, Lamothe's sources were biased in favor of ESP research programs. The classified report circulated through the military and intelligence communities. It was the CIA, not the Defense Department, that took action first. If the Soviets were putting this much effort into psychic and psychotronic research, the United States needed to be one step ahead, and also needed to send that message back over the Iron Curtain. This was the nature of the Cold War, a contest of one-upmanship, and the mandate to outperform the enemy in knowledge and weapons technology. The alarm bell had been sounded. The psychic warfare race with the Soviets had begun. Part 2. The CIA Years. The chessboard is the world. The pieces are the phenomena of the universe. The rules of the game are what we call laws of nature. The player on the other side is hidden from us. Thomas Huxley. Chapter 6. The Enigma of Uri Geller. It was the summer of 1970, and inside the Zahala Tel Aviv home of Moshe Dayan, Israel's Minister of Defense, a 26-year-old former Army paratrooper named Uri Geller sat huddled over a map. Dayan, with his signature black eye patch, was the most famous general in the world, Having recently overseen the capture of East Jerusalem during the 1967 Six-Day War. Geller, with his boyish good looks and boundless charisma, was the most famous psychic in Israel. Soon he would be the most famous psychic in the world. Unknown to most, General Diane had an illicit pastime that involved digging up archaeological treasures across Israel and the Sinai without a license or scientific oversight. His process, he later explained in his memoir, was to drive around the countryside looking for possible ancient dwelling sites to pilfer. Bulldozers preparing ground for construction and cultivation brought to light remains of ancient settlements, wrote Diane. Other times, target sites came to him as, quote, visions, early in the morning after he woke up. I am not superstitious, said the general, nor am I a believer in the prevision of dreams. It may be that what I had dreamed was an ancient site I had passed earlier in the week. Following this intuition, Diane would then drive to the site, comb through the earth, and bring home whatever Canaanite or Philistine relics he found. After cleaning them off and sometimes gluing pieces together, he would put the relics on display in his home. It was dangerous work. In 1968, while looting ancient artifacts from a cave in Azur, Diane was badly injured by a landslide. He spent 3 weeks in the hospital recovering. At his Zahala home, the general's gardens were filled with massive stone artifacts from antiquity, wishing wells, vestibules, cornices, and columns. Inside the study was where the smaller treasures were on display, including tiny statuettes and magic talismans dating back to the time of Eglon and the Book of Judges. It was here, in the presence of this museum-quality collection, that Uri Geller recalls first using his, quote, powers to help Diane find buried treasures, using an ancient form of clairvoyance called map dowsing. I spent hours over the maps, Geller recalled in 2016. Moshe Diane utilized my powers to help him locate ancient artifacts and archaeological finds illegally. I was young and naive at the time. Here I was talking to the Moshe Diane. Dowsing is the ability to locate water, minerals, or man-made objects buried underground by means of a divining rod, usually a forked twig, but also a pendulum or one's hand. Few divinatory practices have incensed modern skeptics as much as dowsing has. In Fads and Fallacies, Martin Gardner pointed out that dowsing was decreed to be satanic by the Inquisition in 1701, only to become a common and respectable practice later in the 18th century, during what was supposed to be the Age of Enlightenment. Then, in 1917, the U.S. Geological Survey declared the matter of water witching to be thoroughly discredited. Some of the most famous dowsers have been illiterates, quipped Gardner, completely puzzled by their odd ability and offering no explanation for it. Dowsing was pure pseudoscience, he said, suspect in every way. Far from a harmless and inexpensive superstition, Gardner wrote, an untold number of dowsers throughout the world were being paid handsomely for their services, and to men of science that seemed unacceptable and wrong. While Geller was not being paid for his map dowsing services in 1970, eventually he would command extraordinary fees for his locating services. In 1986, the Financial Times of London reported Geller's map dowsing fee to be £1 million per job. The most common form of dowsing involves a divining rod or forked stick, believed to be the source of inspiration for the archetypal magic wand. Drawings of men with divining rods have been found in prehistoric cave paintings in North Africa and Peru, dating to 6000 BC. Egyptians, Scythians, and Persians adapted the practice to include swinging pendulums above maps. In medieval Germany, miners used dowsing forks to locate mineral deposits in gold and silver mines. When German miners were imported to England in the 1500s, they brought the art of dowsing with them. In America, dowsing became common in the late 1800s as a means to help homesteaders and farmers locate water and drill wells. The first known use of dowsing techniques by the U.S. military in battle occurred during the Vietnam War. In the winter of 1967, Marines used dowsing rods to locate tunnel systems built by the Viet Cong. The man in charge of training the Marines was Louis J. Matesha, a former topographical surveyor with the Army and a longtime dowser. This classified project was briefly made public on March 13, 1967, when an article appeared in The Observer, a government publication for U.S. forces in Vietnam. Under the headline, "Shades of Black Magic, Marines on Operation Divine for VC Tunnels," a journalist reported that an old-fashioned method of locating water in arid areas, the divining rod, has been updated and put to military use in Vietnam. Marines, using what was identified in the article as Matesha's wire rudder, were skeptical at first, the reporter was told, until they did locate a few Viet Cong tunnels. Private First Class Don R. Steiner explained, "Marines operate the divining rod by holding one in each hand, level with the ground, pointing in the direction of their movement. As the carrier of the two wires moves over, under, or along a hidden structure, the wires will swing into alignment with the structure hidden underground." Steiner said that when he was out on patrol, he watched his rods spread apart as he passed by a Vietnam hut. Upon checking inside the building, Marines discovered a tunnel that led to a family bunker underneath the trail, right where the rods had reacted, Steiner said. The reporter could not locate anyone who could explain how the rods worked and surmised that their action depended, at least in part, on belief. "In this day of nuclear-powered devices, it may seem there is still room for the old, if you happen to be a believer," the reporter wrote. In a 2016 interview for this book, Louis Matesha, age 85, explained that in his opinion, "dowsing is human intelligence. No one knows why it works, only that it works, in all kinds of situations, but not all the time." Matesha shared photographs of his time spent at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, teaching dowsing techniques to Marines with the Counter-Guerrilla Warfare Command, using coat hangers as divining rods to locate booby traps, punji pits, and underground weapons depots, as described in the Observer article. Next, Matesha traveled to Marine Corps Base Quantico in Virginia to demonstrate dowsing techniques for commanders with the Special Warfare Agency and ARPA. Here, engineers had constructed a replica of a Vietnamese village, complete with tunnels and traps, waterways and bridges, and 20 structures, some of which had false ceilings and double walls. In this simulated environment, Matesha used a divining rod to demonstrate how he could locate tunnels, traps, weapons caches, and more. The skill, he said, could be taught to any open-minded Marine. But the commanders were skeptical, Matesha remembers, and declassified documents confirm that the Marine Corps did not go forward with the program involving his dowsing techniques. The cause of an effect is just as important as the results produced in order to formulate doctrine, a declassified memo states. The Marine Corps will again become interested in dowsing only when it can be conclusively demonstrated that the average Marine can employ the technique without regard to his personal convictions, confidence level, or subconscious development. In the age of science and technology, the Corps was unwilling to endorse a technology that was based on something other than the scientific method. In Israel, Moshe Dayan's map-dowsing endeavors with Uri Geller came to an end in 1971 after a group of 20 Israeli archaeologists signed a petition urging the Minister of Defense to give up his legally questionable hobby. In his 1978 memoir, Living with the Bible, Diane discusses his illegally acquired collection and how the archaeology of the Holy Land can be used as a way to reinterpret familiar Bible stories in a new light. He does not mention using Geller as a map dowser. In 1971, Geller had plenty of other work to keep him busy. He was quickly becoming one of Israel's most popular entertainers, bewildering audiences with his mysterious powers of extrasensory perception and psychokinesis. But he was a man at a crossroads, about to be transformed from an obscure Israeli citizen to one of the most scrutinized entertainers in the Western world. The fierce controversies over the authenticity of Geller's powers would become their own hall of mirrors. Born in Israel in December 1946, Uri Geller came into a world informed by war. His parents, Jews living in Budapest, Hungary, had fled Nazi persecution in the late 1930s and taken up residence in the British Mandate of Palestine. In 1946, as Israel fought for independence, sniper fire and street fighting were commonplace. In a BBC television interview in 1987, Geller's mother, Manzi Freud, described the exterior of the family's Tel Aviv apartment complex as being pockmarked with bullet holes. Once, a stray bullet flew into her son's bedroom where he lay sleeping, she said. It narrowly missed the boy and lodged in the wall. The original manifestations of Geller's strange abilities revolved around instruments that measured time, his mother once told the BBC. The first watch he ever wore, a gift from his father when he was 7 years old, stopped working a few hours after the young Uri Geller had strapped it on his wrist. His second watch, a replacement, also stopped working after he put it on, his mother said. The family was poor and life was a struggle, Geller recalls. His mother was a hard-working seamstress, his father a career soldier with a wandering eye. His infidelity devastated my mother, Geller says. His parents divorced when Uri was 10, and he was sent to live on a kibbutz. In this strange new environment, he felt odd and alone. His ability to stop the hands on a watch disappeared. In 1957, Geller's mother married a man named Ladislas Hiero, and the family moved to the Mediterranean island of Cyprus, where Hiero ran a small hotel in Nicosia. Like Israel, Cyprus was marked by violence, its Turkish and Greek inhabitants warring against one another and also against their British occupiers. When Geller was sent to a Catholic boarding school in Nicosia, his unusual abilities returned. He astonished friends with his amazing feats like bending forks, his former teacher, Julie Argrotis, told a British newspaper in 1975. On weekends and holidays, Geller lived in the attic of his stepfather's hotel at 19 Hera Street. One of the hotel's residents at the time was a grain trader from Israel named Yoav Shakam. Tough-looking and powerfully built, in the afternoons, Shakam practiced martial arts in the hotel garden. Geller, now 14, was intrigued by the man and his warrior poses. In an effort to impress the grain trader, Geller says he demonstrated to Shakam how he could bend metal spoons and keys. Shakam was impressed and offered to teach Geller martial arts. A bond grew between the two of them. One day, Geller confided in Yoav Shakam. I said, Yoav, I can read your mind, and I know you are an Israeli spy, Geller recalls. The way Geller remembers the story, Shakam was stunned, his cover compromised by a 14-year-old boy. Geller swore that he wouldn't say a word about it. The reason he told Shakam this, he said, was because he dreamed of growing up and becoming a spy for Israel's intelligence agency, the Mossad. Geller says that Yoav Shakam presented him with a challenge. He told me that when I came of age, I was to join the Israeli army as part of the paratroopers. I was to work hard. I was to become the best soldier I could possibly be, attend officer training school, then find him. Then, and only then, Geller recalls, he said he would get me into the Mossad. This undertaking gave Uri Geller a sense of purpose he had not known before. Geller made a commitment to himself. One day he would work for the Mossad. Determined to succeed, he did precisely what Yoav Shachem told him to do. When he turned 18, he moved back to Israel and volunteered for the paratroopers. In 1965, he became a soldier in the Israeli army. He went through weapons training and learned how to jump out of airplanes. After 11 months, he was accepted into a class for officer training school. But his dream was shattered in the second week of November 1966. A national newspaper reported that Major Yoav Shachem had been killed in action during a skirmish in a Jordanian border town. "I became overwhelmed with grief," Geller recalls. "Sorrow turned to despair. I was so sad and depressed that during the night watch, I fell asleep on the military post. I woke up to a kick in the ribs." "Officers do not fall asleep on watch," Geller was told. "They said I was not officer material and told me to go home." Geller's opportunity to do secret government work for Mossad died with his friend, or so he believed. He returned to his paratrooper unit, unsure of his future and feeling ashamed and insecure. On June 6, 1967, his unit was called to fight in the Six-Day War. He was sent to Ramallah, north of Jerusalem. "We were under tremendous attack by Jordanian Patton tanks," Geller recalls. In search of cover, the unit took shelter in a graveyard. Israeli aircraft were bombing the enemy. There was mortar fire and explosions all around. The company commander, Captain Ehud Shani, was killed instantly. Geller's best friend at the time, Avram Stedler, had his leg blown off and bled to death in front of him. From behind a rock, a Jordanian soldier stood up and raised his weapon at Geller. "I raised my Uzi," says Geller. "He looked into my eye, I looked into his eye. Geller shot first and killed the man." Geller became lost in thought, trying to process what had just occurred. He'd killed a man, an enemy soldier roughly his own age, who just as easily could have killed him. For a few moments, he became oblivious to his surroundings, he says, and did not hear the incoming mortar. There was an explosion, and Geller was knocked unconscious. When he woke up, he was in Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, with shrapnel wounds and a crushed elbow. After surgery, the Israeli army sent him to a rehab center to recover. Unfit to return to active duty, Geller was assigned the job of supervising teenagers at a government-run summer camp. To entertain them, he performed telepathy demonstrations. Among the children at the camp was a 13-year-old boy named Shimson Shippy Strang, who became mesmerized by Geller's abilities. "It was a long time ago, but I was totally amazed by what Uri could do," Strang recalls in 2016. "I'd never seen anything like that before." Shippy asked Geller if he had any other tricks. Geller said they weren't tricks, they were real. He showed Shippy how he could bend a metal spoon by placing two fingers near the neck, concentrating hard and saying, "Bend, bend, bend," like a magical incantation from a storybook. Geller's first paid appearance was a performance at Shippy's middle school the following year. Word spread. Soon, Geller was being paid to perform at dinner parties. Next came small nightclub bookings. Geller's magnetic personality and amazing abilities dazzled audiences, and soon he was selling out 300-seat theaters in uptown Tel Aviv. He was earning real money now, and he bought his mother a state-of-the-art Grundig television set. Stories about Geller began appearing in the press. Who was this Uri Geller? In one interview after another, Geller insisted he was not a stage magician, that his powers were real. Houdini was an illusionist and escape artist who could free himself from shackles, handcuffs, and chains. Henry Blackmore Jr. was a stage magician who made the illusion of sawing a woman in half famous. Geller's own demonstrations were not sleight of hand, he told reporters. He didn't know why he had the powers he possessed, he said, and he often pondered this conundrum himself. But he never wavered from his stated conviction. His powers were real. One day in late 1969 or early 1970, the legal scholar Amnon Rubinstein heard about Uri Geller. Rubinstein was the host of a popular TV show called Boomerang. "We'd just done a show on psychics," Rubinstein explained in 2016 in an interview in Tel Aviv. "I was skeptical of psychics in general. That was the premise of the show. My wife told me we'd been invited to a party where Uri Geller was performing and we had to go and see him. On the way there, I said to her, 'I am a 100% rational man. I do not believe in this,'" Rubinstein recalled. At the party, Rubinstein was standing with a group of guests when the charismatic young Geller walked up to him. He looked me in the eye and said with great conviction, "Pick a number between 1 and 100,000, any number at all." I chose a number and said it aloud. Geller opened his palm. There on the palm, in black ink, it was written, the number I had in my mind. Rubinstein, known as the founding father of Israeli constitutional law, recalls being astonished. "Uri has the unusual power of influencing other people's thoughts," he says. Still, Rubinstein wondered whether what happened was some kind of extraordinary luck. And so, after that first meeting, he tested Geller in his own home, in what he says ended up being countless sessions. He could write something down ahead of time on a piece of paper and hide it, and would then tell me, my wife, or my children to write whatever we wanted, any number, any name, or any capital city, and almost without exception, he was always right, says Rubinstein. He could somehow plant a thought right in our mind. To me, this is so much more significant than spoon bending. This is a single phenomenon that cast doubt on many of the foundations of our rational world. Of Geller's critics, Rubinstein says, "Sure, there are critics, but I'm not one of them. This is the one debate I'm unwilling to have, whether or not Uri Geller's powers are real." Amnon Rubinstein was not the only high-profile Israeli who took an interest in Geller. Across Israel, newspapers began reporting that Geller had admirers in the uppermost echelons of government. Geller had met privately with Brigadier General Aharon Yariv, the head of military intelligence, reported Haaretz. He bent a spoon for Mir Amit, the former chief of Mossad, and was photographed at a function speaking with General Ariel Sharon, according to Maariv. In the summer of 1970, he was seen having lunch with Israel's famous defense minister, Moshe Dayan, at the White Elephant restaurant in Zahala. It was during this lunch that Dayan invited Geller to his house, set the maps in front of him, and asked him to use his powers to locate architectural sites buried underground. With his increasingly high profile, Geller's popularity was on the rise. But it was an event in the fall of 1970 that elevated him to international fame. Geller was giving a telepathy demonstration at the Savata Theater in Tel Aviv when he became physically ill and had to sit down. "Is there a doctor in the house?" he asked. A man came forward and took Geller's vital signs. His pulse was racing between 160 and 170 beats per second, the doctor said. Geller apologized to the audience for the disruption, then made an official-sounding proclamation. The reason he'd become ill, he said, was because a historic event was about to happen or had just occurred. Geller claimed that Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, Israel's sworn enemy at the time, had just died or is about to die. A journalist in the audience named Ruth Heffer ran to a payphone to call her contact at Israel Radio International. There was no news about Nasser coming in over the wires, Heffer learned. When the journalist returned to the theater, she found Geller still seated on a stool looking ill. Audience members were filing out, some demanding that their money be returned. 20 minutes had passed when someone ran into the room shouting. Radio Cairo had just announced that President Nasser was dead. At 6 o'clock that evening, he'd suffered a heart attack and died. With this news, Uri Geller's reputation skyrocketed. At a New Year's Day press conference, Prime Minister Golda Meir was asked what lay in store for Israel in the coming year. "Don't ask me," she was quoted as saying. "Ask Uri Geller." That first moment of national fame did not last long. "After that, I fell off the map," Geller recalls. "Israel is a small country. It was as if everyone had seen my act. I did telepathy, stopped and started watches, bent spoons. People wanted more. They wanted magic, but I'm not a magician. I could not add or invent new tricks." Geller watched with dismay as his audiences began to thin. "I moved into smaller theaters," Geller recalls, "and even smaller theaters after that." Then, one night, an American scientist named Andrea Puharik showed up at a nightclub where Geller was performing. Uri Geller's life would soon take another radical turn. The nightclub Zorba was located in the old quarter of the ancient port town of Jaffa, and on the night of August 17, 1971, Uri Geller was backstage getting ready for a telepathy demonstration. It was a barn of a place, decorated with crepe paper lanterns and strings of holiday lights, a favorite Israeli summer spot. A rock band played on a large stage. During intermission, jugglers entertained the audience. Finally, it was time for the evening's main attraction. "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Uri Geller," said the announcer. The tall, charismatic Geller emerged from backstage as the crowd went wild with applause. With his thick mop of black hair, hip dress, and lanky body, Geller looked more like a member of an English rock band than a telepath. He picked up the microphone and made a modest announcement. "With the cooperation of the audience," Geller said, "I am going to try to demonstrate simple telepathy and psychokinesis. I hope I will succeed." He sat down on a stool facing the audience. His assistant, the now 17-year-old Shippy Strang, blindfolded Geller as a freestanding chalkboard was wheeled on stage. "First," said Geller, "he would perform a mind-reading act. With Strang's help, audience members would come forward to write 3-digit numbers on the blackboard, which faced away from Geller. Before Geller made a guess, he asked everyone in the audience to concentrate hard on what had been written on the board, because his powers were enhanced by audience participation. Eyeless sight was a basic form of mental telepathy," Geller explained, "the ancient ability to see without using one's eyes. Among various divinatory practices, the term seeing was used to connote insight, augury, or interpretation. The word seer comes from the verb to see, and it appears in the Bible, but in basic telepathy or eyeless sight, it was literal," Geller said. Audience members lined up to participate. In one instance after the next, Geller would take a few moments to concentrate before writing a 3-digit number on a notepad in his lap. Still blindfolded, he would hold up the notepad for the audience to see and say aloud what he'd written in this alleged demonstration of eyeless sight. This night, as most nights, he was correct roughly 90% of the time. Next, he moved on to a similar set of trials, this time guessing the names of capital cities with similar results. After the show, a man approached Geller. He was middle-aged and eccentric-looking, with a frizzy mop of unkempt hair and a thick mustache like the one Albert Einstein wore. The man spoke with an American accent and introduced himself as Dr. Andrea Puharik. The two had spoken briefly on the telephone a few weeks before, Puharik reminded Geller. He was the American research scientist and neurophysiologist interested in examining Geller from a medical point of view. Geller agreed to meet Puharik the following day at the Tel Aviv home of an Israeli army officer. When Geller arrived at the address, he marveled at the scientist's gadgetry. The room was filled with equipment, Geller recalled in 2016. Thermometers, compasses, clocks, watches, a reel-to-reel audio recorder, and a Konica 8mm film camera, which was very state-of-the-art back then. Puharik did not tell Geller that he was keeping track of the experiments as part of a CIA research proposal he was working on, one that he would title a research program whose goal is to unambiguously resolve the question as to whether or not direct brain perception and direct brain action exist. In declassified documents obtained as part of a 2015 Freedom of Information Act request for this book, Puharik told the CIA that he and an Israeli army officer named Simcha Siloni had witnessed Uri Geller breaking a gold ring held in another person's clenched fist, concentrating on a pair of bimetal-type thermometers and selectively making the temperature rise 6 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit on one or the other instrument, starting broken clocks and watches solely by concentration, moving the hands of a watch forward or backward without any physical contact with the watch, and telepathy with 90% accuracy in telepathy tests where Dr. Puharik would think of a 3-digit number. After spending 2 weeks testing Uri Geller in the summer of 1971, Puharik was convinced that Geller's abilities would be of interest to the CIA. From his contacts in the intelligence world, Puharik suspected the agency was looking for its own Nina Kulagina to test in a lab. Puharik did not tell Geller about his plans involving the CIA. Instead, he simply told Geller that his extraordinary powers should not be wasted in Israeli nightclubs, but that he should be tested in a laboratory setting in the United States. Geller asked Amnon Rubinstein for advice. I told him absolutely he should go be tested in America at a serious research institute like Stanford, remembers Rubinstein. Puharik returned to the United States after telling Geller he'd be in touch soon. From his home in Ossining, he put together a research proposal and submitted it to his CIA contact for review. The situation was sensitive, recalls Dr. Kit Green, the scientist who ran the CIA's Life Sciences Division at the time. Green would soon become Uri Geller's handler and was interviewed at length for this book. The report was escalated to the top. In fact, the decision to test Geller was a decision made by CIA Director Richard Helms, which I know because I am the one who received his call, confirms Green. Except there was a hurdle to overcome. The CIA wanted Geller, but they also wanted to distance themselves from Puharik. In declassified documents, CIA analysts describe Puharik as a potential liability, with whom many unsavory reports have been linked. A shell entity needed to be created through which Geller-related funds could flow and Puharik could be paid, ideally an organization or a person of solid repute. Puharik knew exactly the right person. His name was Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut and Apollo 14 crew member. Chapter 7. The Man on the Moon. Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell became fascinated by the idea of mental telepathy in 1967 while reading a book about mind-to-mind experiments conducted by the polar explorer and decorated war hero Sir Hubert Wilkins. These experiments gave Ed Mitchell an idea. He'd just begun astronaut training and decided that if he were chosen to voyage to the moon, he'd conduct his own mental telepathy experiments on the way. In Wilkin's book, Thoughts Through Space, A Remarkable Adventure in the Realm of Mind, the aviator described ESP experiments he carried out while searching for a group of lost Russian explorers whose airplane went down over the North Pole in 1938. It's a remarkable story by a remarkable man, Mitchell recalled in a 2015 interview at his home in Florida. A shame most people have forgotten about him. People forget history, and that's the way it is. Mitchell related to Wilkins because Wilkins was a voyager of the First Order, one of the world's most famous explorers of the modern era. He was a larger-than-life individual whose daring feats commanded respect wherever he went. In 1926, he became the first man to fly from North America to the polar regions of Europe, proving there was no continent under the Arctic ice. He led multiple expeditions to the Arctic and Antarctic, and in 1931, attempted to reach the North Pole in a surplus World War I submarine. After his death in November 1958, the U.S. Navy took his ashes to the North Pole aboard the nuclear submarine USS Skate and scattered them in the majestic Arctic as the great explorer had requested. Now, as Ed Mitchell prepared for his moon voyage, his interest in extrasensory perception grew. All his life, he'd been a rule follower, a naval officer, and an aviator, a test pilot and an aeronautical engineer. But then, in 1961, while getting his PhD in aeronautics and astronautics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, he began studying topics that expanded and altered his worldview, including quantum mechanics, galactic evolution, and star evolution. These were abstruse subjects, Mitchell later recalled. No one knew the answers to the questions they posed. Studying these concepts, he found himself increasingly interested in what science had not yet figured out. I would lie awake at night wondering about the meaning of life and man's place in the universe, Mitchell recalled. Selected for astronaut training, he began practicing meditation and yoga. Meditation produces qualitative and beneficial shifts in psychophysiological conditions, he said. And as he prepared for the voyage into outer space, he started to contemplate the meaning of inner space, or human consciousness. What does consciousness mean? And how do outer space and inner space align? At 4:02 in the afternoon of January 31st, 1971, there was no more time to wonder what it would be like in outer space. Apollo 14 was minutes from launch, and Ed Mitchell braced himself for what was about to unfold. Here on a tiny spit of land off the coast of Florida, Ed Mitchell, Alan Shepard, and Stuart Roosa were about to leave planet Earth. The clock was ticking, and from a technical standpoint, the danger on board this rocket ship was rising. Training helps an astronaut master extraordinary human functioning, an unusual degree of control over what transpires within his or her body. At any given moment in space, a myriad of things can go wrong. And to exist in this state for an extended period of time requires immediate focus and attention. We'd spent 10% of our time studying plans for the mission and 90% learning how to react intuitively to all the what-ifs, Mitchell later recalled. To prepare for space travel and for landing on the moon, the Apollo astronauts cultivated extraordinary human functioning, Mitchell says. They learned to develop intention techniques. To get to the moon and back, they would have to function in an extremely hostile environment for more than 200 consecutive hours on very little sleep. Whereas another man's adrenaline might spike to dangerous levels, astronauts trained their minds to keep their bodies calm. This is not something that can be faked. Every breath and every heartbeat of each of the Apollo astronauts would be monitored by aerospace doctors on the ground in real time. The mind has to convince the body all is well. Through training, this can be done, Mitchell said. On land, they had rehearsed for every contingency they could face on the mission, including how to withstand G-forces, how to maneuver in zero-gravity conditions, and how to scale craters and climb hills in environments that mimicked the moon's. It was now just a few minutes to blast off, and Ed Mitchell sat buckled into a small seat inside the cone-shaped spaceship attached near the top of the Saturn V rocket. The rocket was taller than the Statue of Liberty and weighed 6.2 million pounds. It was in this quiet moment, anticipating blast and fury, that Mitchell accepted that there was nothing for him to do but sit still. Here was the moment when the mind could be called upon to keep the body calm, Mitchell recalled in 2015. The scientist in him knew that inside the lower portion of the rocket, there were more than 66,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen fuel. In a matter of seconds, a small pyrotechnic device would deliver a spark, ignite the fuel, and cause the massive explosion necessary to generate thrust. If everything went right, the three men would be on their way to the moon. If anything went wrong, they would die instantly in an inferno. 20 seconds passed. There were now 50 seconds to go. The upper access arms connecting the space capsule to the scaffolding released and swung away. "Initiate firing command," boomed a voice. NASA computers took charge. Inside the space capsule, Ed Mitchell listened to the rushing sounds of liquid as thousands of gallons of propellants sped through the rocket's fuel lines. He could hear the turbo pumps spinning as the countdown continued. 10, 9, 8. Kerosene and liquid oxygen hurtled into the combustion chambers of the first stage engine of the Saturn V. Next came ignition, then fire and flames. Pad 39A trembled in an explosion of fuel. Computers indicated to NASA technicians that there was sufficient power to launch. The clock reached zero, and the rocket's massive hold-down arms fell away. Apollo 14 lifted off the launch pad, headed for the moon. The moon, Earth's only natural satellite, a subject of mystery and mysticism since the dawn of recorded history. The moon is thought to have formed some 4.5 billion years ago, its origins inextricably linked to the earliest evolution of Earth. The Apollo 14 voyage to the moon was for NASA a pivotal moment in its attempt to understand these origins. This was the first lunar landing mission to focus on science and geology rather than space travel techniques. Ed Mitchell and Alan Shepard would collect rock samples from a meteor impact site called Cone Crater and bring these samples home. Geologists believed that this data could provide a view of the ancient aftermath of the cataclysmic impact believed to have left debris across the moon's surface 1 billion years before. Hours passed. Time and motion took on an exceptional dimension, Mitchell later recalled. As Apollo 14 made its way to the moon, the spacecraft rotated slowly so the side facing the sun wouldn't get too hot. Mitchell closed his eyes and experienced the sensation of standing still. He took a pen from his bag and released it, then marveled as it floated through the air in front of him. Out here in space, there appeared to be no up or down. He reached for the telescope and used it to look out the window at the stars. In 1595, the microscope opened up the world of small-scale science, of biology. 13 years later, in 1608, the telescope opened up wide-scale science, the world of cosmology. What 20th-century instrument would open up the study of consciousness? Ed Mitchell wondered, the unsolved mystery that is the human mind. The Apollo 14 astronauts ate their freeze-dried dinner, went to the bathroom, and brushed their teeth. Now it was time to sleep. Each astronaut pulled down his nearest window shade to shut out the bright light of the sun. Each was allowed to bring along personal reading material and music to help him fall asleep. After some minutes of quiet time, the schedule indicated lights out. I did not intend to fall asleep immediately, Ed Mitchell recalled in 2015. He had an alternative plan in place. He was going to conduct a secret experiment that had been arranged with three civilian colleagues back on Earth, two physicians, and a Swedish-born psychic named Olof Johnson. Just as Sir Hubert Wilkins had done 3 decades before, Ed Mitchell intended to conduct a long-distance, mind-to-mind telepathy experiment right here in outer space. Mitchell would act as the sender, Olof Johnson as the receiver. Two of Mitchell's physician friends, Edward Maxey and Edward Boyle, would act as witnesses, sitting with Johnson in his Chicago apartment. Doctors Maxey and Boyle had helped train Mitchell in extraordinary human functioning techniques by teaching him advanced scuba diving techniques. Mitchell reached into his bag and pulled out a clipboard and a secret set of 5 Zener cards, now a staple in modern ESP experiments. On each card was a symbol: circle, square, star, cross, 3 wavy lines. He flipped the cards over so he couldn't see the symbols, then shuffled the deck. He chose a card at random and turned it over. Staring at the symbol, he concentrated for 15 seconds. With his pen, he noted on his clipboard the precise time it was on Earth and the symbol he'd been staring at. He repeated this effort 25 times, each time with a new Zener card randomly chosen from the 5. The process took approximately 7 minutes. When he finished, he put his things away and went to sleep. 80 hours passed. Edgar Mitchell grew a beard. He longed for a bath and a slice of his mother's apple pie. From one of the craft's 5 windows, he looked back and forth between the moon's mysterious surface and a map in his hands. Men have been making maps of the moon since the days of cuneiform writing. This particular map had been made by NASA and was the product of data collected on previous flights. Ed Mitchell was an expert navigator and map reader, and it was his job to take this map with him when he and Shepard got to the surface of the moon. "The moon looks huge," he told Houston Control. Their target, Cone Crater, was getting closer. Almost visible now, Mitchell could see the upper end of the Sea of Fertility and noted how much darker it was than everything around it. "There's Theophilus," he told Houston. "The craters look fresh, vivid." He saw the Descartes site, the Albategnius crater, Herschel's west wall. He marveled at the long shadows and the rugged landscape. Finally, he located the eastern edge of Frau Mauro, their designated landing site. Remarkably, as long as everything went according to schedule, their destination was just a few hours away. The Kitty Hawk command module was orbiting the moon now, at an altitude of roughly 10 miles. "This scale is so deceiving," Mitchell said. "We could be 500 feet in the air the way this terrain looks," he told NASA. "Tracking the landmarks is rather phenomenal." After 10 rotations around the moon, it was undocking time for the Antares lander. Mitchell and Alan Shepard prepared for their landing. Stu Roosa would remain inside Kitty Hawk, in orbit for 2 days until rendezvous and the return journey back to Earth. Mitchell and Shepard readied themselves, then squeezed down into the tunnel that connected the command module to Antares. A deep breath, a leap of faith. Ready, set, go. Shepard opened the hatch. Out they went and into the lunar module. Antares was their lifeline to the moon and back. Before their final descent to the surface, Shepard and Mitchell were required to fly the lunar module around the backside of the moon 2 more times. Each orbit took between 90 minutes and 2 hours. Mitchell felt an incredible psychological tension in the lunar module, he said, and he wondered whether his fellow astronauts had felt this strain too. He looked at the map of the Fra Mauro landing site and compared it with the visuals out the window. "Looks just like the map," he told Houston optimistically. He felt excitement as energy coursed through his body. Time passed. Now there was one last trip around the moon. As Al and I orbited only a few thousand meters above the highest lunar peaks, the familiar gray landscape became recognizable, he recalled in his memoir. There were mountains and valleys, a sun in the sky. For the first time in 3 days, there was a relative up and down. The tiny Earth in the distance appeared as a satellite of the moon. But this time, as the two Apollo astronauts emerged from the backside of the moon, something technical went terribly wrong. On the instrument panel, an abort signal flashed. In outer space, abort is not a nuanced word. Abort indicates halt, discontinue, terminate. This signal flashed again and again, indicating that there was something catastrophically wrong with the computer guidance system. Mitchell's mind scanned through various scenarios, he recalled in 2015. He had to stay focused on the solution. He could not allow his mind to think negatively, to consider that they may have come 240,000 miles, only to be told to turn around and go home. He could not allow himself to think about Apollo 13, which suffered a technological failure that canceled its moon landing and very nearly killed the astronauts on board. "Keep the mind focused," Mitchell said to himself. "Consider the mysterious cadence of serendipity." A voice from Houston interrupted his thoughts. "Ed, I wonder if you could try tapping the instrument panel," someone said. Mitchell tapped the panel. My God, he thought, the light actually went off. Filled with an enormous sense of relief, Mitchell took a deep inhale, then exhaled. Then the abort light came back on. With detached acceptance, Mitchell says he wondered again whether they had really traveled all this way to turn back without landing on the moon. "Try tapping the panel a bit again," Houston said. "Okay," Mitchell agreed, and tapped it. "You tapped it again, right?" someone in Houston asked. Yes, he'd tapped it. This time, nothing happened. The abort light continued to flash red. He and Shepard waited to hear what Houston said next. The silence was agonizing, he later recalled. Houston suggested they make another rotation around the moon. "Do not think about this as rotation unlucky number 13, Mitchell told himself. Houston would work on the problem while the two astronauts were on the far side, or dark side, of the moon, where there is no communication or signal line back to Earth. Have faith. Believe in serendipity, Mitchell repeated to himself, like a mantra. Back in Houston, it was 2 a.m. At the Johnson Space Center, NASA engineers and technicians had little choice but to try to figure out how to bypass the abort command. This meant calling a man named Don Iles in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Iles, age 27, was the computer scientist who had designed the guidance system on Antares. When NASA called, Iles was at the instrument laboratory at MIT, watching the Apollo 14 mission on TV. He needed to design a workaround that would cause the spaceship's computer to override its own abort signal, and he had less than 2 hours to do it. We deceived the program by telling it an abort was already in progress, Iles recalled in 2016. It was a 61 keystroke solution. Houston relayed these 61 keystrokes to Ed Mitchell on Antares, who copied them down on a notepad. After they emerged from the far side and were in the first few seconds of their initial descent engine burn, Mitchell entered these critical keystrokes into the computer in an exact order and at precisely the right times, while simultaneously preparing to land. But now there was another problem. Dealing with the abort signal had lengthened the mission. The new danger was that fuel was running out. The astronauts had to get down to the surface without delay. Shepard ran calculations. Based on the amount of fuel they had remaining in the landing tanks, even with a flawless landing, the astronauts would have only seconds to spare before they would run out of fuel. Mitchell focused his mind on landing. He could not allow his thoughts to linger on danger or fear. Never mind that the abort signal had been turned off manually. This meant that if the astronauts really did need to abort for safety reasons, there would be no indicator alerting them to take that action. The need to abort was now going to be a manual call. Mitchell and Shepard were readying for their descent onto the surface when a flashing light indicated a new problem. The landing radar was malfunctioning. Antares' landing radar system allowed the craft to sense proximity to the surface as the module descended. Without this radar, there would be no way to safely touch down. The target area on Fra Mauro was littered with boulders and meteor impact craters. The radar was designed to allow the craft to land on flat ground. Neither manual nor visual sensing was possible because the astronauts were facing upward during descent. If Antares landed on an incline, there was considerable risk that the module could tip over. And if it tipped over, it could not be righted by two men. The astronauts would run out of oxygen and die on the moon. Mitchell could feel his adrenaline soaring. Time was running out. Fuel was running low. As the lunar module pilot, landing was up to him. But this new code he'd just typed into the onboard system had somehow interfered with the landing radar. According to mission control rules, without landing radar, there could be no landing on the moon. At NASA, rules were rules. In 2015, Mitchell recalled Alan Shepard looking over at him and shaking his head in solidarity and disbelief. What was going to happen? Had they really come this far to abort before they set foot on the moon? If they were unable to land, surely this would be the end of the entire Apollo program. Mitchell took a deep breath. The communication channels were loud with static, he recalled. With all the noise, it was hard to hear. Unable to come up with anything else to do, He commanded the radar to obey. "Come on, radar," he said aloud. "Lock on." An excruciating moment, then another. And just like that, said Mitchell, in the nick of time, the radar started up and locked in. The astronauts looked at their instrument panel. Shepard looked out the window. They were exactly where they were supposed to be. "Right on the money," Mitchell told Houston. "Right on the money," Shepard agreed. "You are go for a landing," said Houston. "Shoot for the moon," Shepard said. Mitchell read his position to Houston. They were at 2,048 feet, coming down a little fast. 1,500 feet. 500 feet. 100 feet. Starting down. 90 feet. 50 feet. 40. 20. Mitchell felt a bump. The footpads of Antares hit the moon. "We're on the surface," Mitchell said. Mitchell had made the most precise landing to date, approximately 87 feet from the targeted landing point. "It felt tremendous," he later recalled. So little was known about this place. Only four explorers had been here before, on Apollo 11 and Apollo 12. The total time humans had spent on this lunar landscape was just 53 hours and 7 minutes. No one knows for sure how the moon was formed, only that it was most likely once part of Earth. The prevailing theory is that the moon was formed when the formerly larger Earth, called the Proto-Earth, was impacted by a Mars-sized object that hit Earth with such force that it ejected debris that later formed our moon. One thing was certain. Earth, with its moving plates and erupting volcanoes, was very different from the moon, in that Earth destroys its own record over millions of years. The airless moon is different. It appears to have no moving plates, and for this reason, scientists believe the moon's surface has likely preserved a record of its history since it first formed. The idea that humans could learn more about Earth's origins by investigating what remains on the moon, by collecting rock samples from inside and outside the craters and bringing the samples back to Earth, was guiding the mission that lay ahead. Mitchell and Shepard were to collect rock samples from the 1,100-foot-wide, 750-foot-deep Cone Crater. That was the target. At last, Antares was on the moon. It hadn't crashed. It also hadn't landed on level ground, so it tilted to one side. The unsettling feeling that the craft might tip over was not something Mitchell could allow his mind to linger on. Before the astronauts could leave Antares and step onto the moon's surface, they had 4 hours of duties to perform. They consulted their checklists, performed their tasks, and sent status reports to Houston. Mitchell affixed a 16-millimeter camera, the Maurer Data Acquisition Camera, to his side of the module and pointed it out the window to record terrain and engineering data for future missions. After completing the work on their checklists, the astronauts began procedures to open the hatch. Finally, the time had come. Alan Shepard went first, Ed Mitchell right behind. As he made his way down the ladder, he heard Houston say, "Okay, Ed, we can see you coming down." A camera mounted on the lower part of the module was recording their descent and broadcasting the images back on Earth. Mitchell jumped past the last step and landed on the surface. "I stepped over a few craters that were filled with dust," he later recalled. "Then I looked up at the sky. It was inky black, without a star in sight, and I couldn't see the Earth at all." He stood for a moment, gazing at this amazing new place. Then he got to work. Looking around, Mitchell realized they were in the middle of a large boulder field. "It covers perhaps as much as a square mile," Shepard told Houston as they began the first of 2 4.5-hour excursions on the lunar surface. They erected a flag and assembled TV equipment. They set up a miniature thermonuclear station designed to power monitoring equipment for years to come. They took photographs and shot film. Then they rested inside the module and prepared for the second excursion to their target, Cone Crater. For their journey, the astronauts would take with them 3 ancient tools: a wheelbarrow in which to carry things, a gnomon to check and measure shadows, and a map with which to navigate. Mitchell carried the map. They took turns dragging the wheelbarrow across the lunar surface, which reminded Mitchell of a tractor moving through a plowed field. They set down the gnomon and photographed its shadows. They took samples and trudged on. Then, back in Houston, a devastating realization emerged. They aren't where they think they are. They were on the moon, and they were lost. Scientists and engineers in Houston calculated, then recalculated, and then concurred. The astronauts were overestimating the rate of their progress by as much as a factor of 2. Disagreements followed. Mitchell and Shepard had entirely different interpretations of where they were in relation to Cone Crater. They argued. Then Houston piped in to try and help problem solve. Mitchell expressed his anger with the geologists. This was their fault, he said. They were far too preoccupied with rocks. While the astronauts endeavored to determine their location, back in Houston, the engineers drew their own conclusions. "They think they have completed a little under half their journey," said one scientist, "when in reality, they had completed only about a third." Mitchell told Houston that the bubble of his spacesuit was distorting his vision. He said his perception was off and was messing with his ability to accurately process information. "There were craters hidden behind other craters," he said. As he struggled to get his bearings, he reported seeing car-sized boulders on a rim. His primary problem in navigation was the surprising roughness of the terrain, he said. Everything looked closer than it was. Mitchell summoned his astronaut training and focused his attention on the task at hand, he later recalled. "Keep moving," he told himself. "Gaze out, not in." At Johnson Space Center, scientists and technicians examined charts and moon maps. On the moon, Shepard was having as difficult a time as Mitchell was. "There's hardly a level spot anywhere," Shepard said. He lost his footing and fell. Mitchell hurried to his side and helped him to his feet. "One or both of them is breathing heavily," Houston noted. Mitchell eyed a boulder. "Strange," he noted aloud. Embedded in the boulders, Mitchell reported seeing huge chunks of glass. He began to perspire. Frustration affects physiology, and Mitchell's metabolism rose to a rate higher than it had been at any time on this journey. "I'm going on medium cooling," he told Houston, adjusting the cooling system on his portable life support system. His heart rate rose to 100 beats per minute. Houston told both astronauts to sit down. "Why don't we pull up beside this big crater?" Mitchell said to Shepard. "Take a break, get the map, and see if we can't find out exactly where we are." They rested. Mitchell consulted his map. Finally, the two men stood up, having agreed to make another go at it. "I think I know where we are," Mitchell said. In Houston, the flight surgeon noted that Shepard's heart was now beating at 120 beats per minute. "Putting the map away," Mitchell said. The astronauts resumed walking. The grade was getting steeper. Shepard sounded winded. Mitchell took photographs, with a Hasselblad electric data camera, with its specially designed lens and glass plate that placed reference crosses on each image to help determine distance and height. Shepard's heart rate rose to 150 beats per minute. Mitchell's slowed to 115, then raced back up to 128. The flight surgeon instructed the men to stop and rest again. "Our positions are all in doubt now," Mitchell said. "Perhaps you can think with us if you want," Shepard suggested to Houston. "Distance became plastic," Mitchell later recalled, enhanced by the unreal clarity of the airless scene. He ordered his mind to stay focused. "Now that we were on the lunar surface, our estimates in distance were in error by 100%, as objects typically appeared one half as far away as they really were," he later said. "Pause, regroup, keep moving in that order," Mitchell told himself. "Get to Cone Crater. That is the goal." Then came the moment. Shepard suggested they turn around. Mitchell considered what was being said. Shepard was older and wiser. 10 years earlier, in 1961, he had become the first American in space. Now, age 47, he struggled for breath as he labored across the surface of the moon. "No, let's keep going around this crater," Mitchell insisted. "We can't stop without looking into Cone Crater," he told Houston. That was the goal. They could not come all this way without getting to the target. Ed Mitchell was not prepared to fail. Houston gave them permission to leave their wheelbarrow behind. They were given a 30-minute extension to reach the rim. His breathing labored, Mitchell said, "Let's take a look at the map." More bad news. He realized he was looking at a very distinct map marker and that it was a landmark he thought they had already passed. This was terribly, terribly frustrating, Mitchell recalled. On Earth, a decision was made. This was it, the turning point, the final call. "Turn back now," Houston said. The astronauts turned around. They saw Antares in the distance, slightly tipped. "We kangaroo hopped our way back down the slope, taking giant leaps through the void that is the lunar atmosphere,"